you found the number one internet site for irreverent, cool, and entertaining talk programming. It's LA Talk Radio. We say what we want.
You're listening to the Maria Sanchez Show on LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com. The Maria Sanchez Show, a conversation, not a confrontation, on LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com.
Thank you, Linda O'Brien. Good morning. This is Maria Sanchez, heard weekdays live, 9 o'clock Pacific, Monday through Friday, obviously, at latalkradio.com, and then later that day available for download, for listening on demand, on iTunes, also at mariasanchezshow.com and themariasanchezshow.com. We're live Friday, June 14th. Thank you so much for joining us. Coming up during the program, we have State Senator Hannah Beth Jackson visiting with us. She's going to be speaking about the California budget and needs to be approved shortly. They may even be voting on it as soon as today. And we also have as a guest former Ventura County elected Sheriff Bob Brooks. For 12 years he served over that capacity. He has written a book, and it's entitled Declarations, Living and Leading Above Your Circumstances. So he's going to share his thoughts about that and do a little bit of a retrospective on his career. But as we always do, we try and give you the latest in the news, and today is no exception. What they're calling the NSA leaker, or there's another word out there that is describing him, is a hacktivist. We had our circumcision correspondent on earlier this week, and he is called an intactivist about genital integrity. So there's these new words coming out as the times change. And Australia's in the news with a word that our circumcision correspondent mentioned earlier this week, too, called intersex. So we'll go into that because that's in the news also. But so more details are coming out about Edward Snowden and who he is and what he has done. He was born in 1983 in North Carolina. He grew up in Maryland. In a suburb near the NSA headquarters. He is a high school dropout. He left in the 10th grade, and he later earned a GED. At 18, he worked as a webmaster for Ryana Press, which was a startup promoting Japanese anime artists. And he began another life on the Internet, and they're calling these people children of the Internet, or the Internet people, and they're coming of age with the Internet. So he started making posts as many as 750 over the years on a site known as Ars Techniac. And they said that he gave advice more than he asked for it, and they were not political in nature in general. But he was a prolific commentator on it's a technology forum. So he was employed by the CIA from 2006 to 2009, where he primarily worked overseas, and by Dell from 2009 to 2013, when he worked in the United States and Japan as an NSA contractor. So they're also saying, how did he get the information out? They're calling it theft by thumb drive. He just walked out with a thumb drive in his pocket. In October 2008, the NSA discovered that a thumb drive loaded with malware had infected the military's secure internal network. So at that time, the Pentagon at least temporarily banned the use of thumb drives, and they even reportedly ordered the USB ports filled in with liquid cement. Well, that would do the job. But of course, there's always exceptions, and there are people who need to use a thumb drive, and they have special permission. So that doesn't appear to have fazed him, because now not only do investigators know that he pilfered the top secret files on a thumb drive, they know how many documents he downloaded and what server he took them from. So what happened is that he worked for this Bose Allen Hamilton contracting firm in Hawaii for just about 4 weeks before he asked to take an unpaid leave. That was after a week, because he had some medical issues. So he left the job. He said that he was ill. He requested a leave without pay. When Booz Allen checked in with him, he said that he was suffering from epilepsy and he needed more time off. When he failed to return after an even longer period and the company couldn't find them, they notified intelligence officials because of his high-level security clearance. So our government agents spent days in the field trying to find him. but they were unable to do so. And then the story in The Guardian was released, as well as in The Washington Post. The government didn't know that Snowden was the source for the stories until he admitted it on Sunday. That's according to Reuters. So they were looking for a guy. They couldn't find him. Things are published. They don't know it's him. It's kind of scary. I think that they should have known more, at least after they were called when he's missing, MIA. The Santa Monica shooter, they found a 3-page farewell note on his body. This was revealed yesterday in a police press conference. And in it, he bid goodbye to his friends and expressed hope that his mother would be provided for financially and apologized for killing his father and his brother. He didn't offer any explanation for why he killed them, nor did he express any anger. So the semi-automatic rifle that he had was assembled from component parts, which is illegal under the state of California's gun laws, because we here in California banned the purchase and possession of assault-style weapons unless they were acquired by the owner before June 1989. And the Santa Monica Police Chief Jacqueline Seabrook said that investigators believe mental illness was also a factor, because law enforcement was called when he was 16 or 17 years old in 2006, and he was placed under a 72-hour psychiatric hold. But the circumstances around that incident haven't been revealed. So we have two huge profile divorces in the news today. One is News Corp Chief Executive Rupert Murdoch yesterday filed for divorce from his wife of 14 years, Wendy. He's 82. She's 44. They got married in 1999. They have two young daughters. Forbes says his worth is $9.4 billion, but they had a prenuptial agreement, the details of which haven't been shared yet. Murdoch also has four other children, one from his first marriage and three from his second marriage. And so the story behind Wendy Deng, which I didn't know until I read this morning, she came to the United States in 1988 after serving as an interpreter for a Los Angeles couple who had been working in China. She's speaking Mandarin. She's from China. The couple sponsored her to live with them. And later, the husband left his wife and married her. So isn't that a nice little ending to that story? After their brief marriage, she went on to get an MBA from Yale, and she got a job at News Corp Star TV as an intern in 1996. She met Murdoch in 1998 when she was a junior executive who acted as his interpreter during a business trip to China. They married shortly after Murdoch divorced his wife of 31 years, Anna. Now, Anna had a position on News Corp's board until 1998. Wendy Deng apparently has not had any of capacities like that. So on to the next divorce story, which is Harold Hamm and his wife, Sue Ann, a name you might not know, but they're big because he owns more oil in the ground than any other American. So he's 67, and they have filed for divorce. They're saying the $1.7 billion payout that Rupert Murdoch paid to his wife, ex-wife Anna, in 1999 is most likely going to pale in comparison to the one that this Harold Hamm is going to have to deal with. They're estimating that the settlement could cost him about $3 billion or more. So he is a self-made man. He is the 13th child of Oklahoma sharecroppers. He started his career at the age of 20 scrubbing the scum from oil barrels. A few years later, he drilled a 75-barrel-a-day gusher in his home state, and then he founded Continental in 1967, 20 years before he was married to Sue Ann. So they wed in Las Vegas in April 1988, 6 months after his first divorce was granted. And Sue Ann is an attorney with a law degree from the University of Tulsa, and she handled land deals for Continental. So the amazing story that they have is that he was a millionaire when he married her. Now he's a billionaire. In the late 90s, he helped discover the Bakken Field of North Dakota, which is the largest new U.S. oil prospect since the 1960s. Today, the Bakken yields nearly 700,000 barrels a day, about 10% of our American output. And they control Continental, his company, controls more than 1 million acres in the formation, which goes from North Dakota to Montana. Continental has said that the entire Bakken region, which is being developed by several companies, may contain 24 billion barrels of oil, which would be enough to meet the United States demand for more than 3 years. So two big high-profile divorces in the news today. And now we're going to be speaking with State Senator Hannah Beth Jackson. She's taken the time to visit with us to talk about the California budget. And she has a little
Senator
feel-good
Jackson's office. This is Miriam.
Hi, it's Maria Sanchez for the Senator, please. Good morning.
Good morning. One second.
Thank you. So she also has a feel-good story about a section of a highway that she named for, and I'll let her share that, which is kind of cute, too. But the budget is in the news because they need to get it done, and she's taken the time to visit with us, which is really precious because obviously she's busy. She is an educator, former state assembly member, and a former deputy district attorney. She was elected to represent the 35th Assembly District, which encompasses big portions of Ventura and Santa Barbara counties.
Hello.
Good morning.
Hannah Beth Jackson.
Hi. It's Maria Sanchez. Good morning. Thank you for joining us this morning. We know how busy you are, and we appreciate you taking the time to share your thoughts
with us. Well, I appreciate your calling to allow me to talk with your listeners and let them know what's going on up here.
Well, without further ado, why don't you give us your interpretation, please?
Well, we're going to be voting on the budget today. It's going to be an on-time budget. It's balanced. I think it's a responsible budget, and at the same time, I think it's got some visionary aspects to it so that as we go about trying to repair the damage that was done by the Great Recession and the enormous cuts that the state has taken over the past few years, we're really going to be able to get California back on track and get it moving again.
And I understand if you approve it, that it's going to be the first one since 2007 to be balanced without kind of steep cuts or fancy Ponzi things where you move stuff in and out.
Well, that is correct. It is a balanced budget, you know, because of the recession, because of the games played on Wall Street that almost took down the world economically. California suffered, part of it was due to the housing problems that were created by the lack of oversight and regulation on our building and our financial industries. This is now an example of how things have turned around. The state's moving again fiscally. We are in much better shape, but the devastation that's been done to the state is really what we're trying to focus on now. We've picked ourselves up by the bootstraps. We've got the money now, but we're not spending it all. The governor insisted upon a rather substantial reserve and insisted also that we look at a very conservative year rather than what many of us believe we're going to probably end up with a lot more money in the bank just because we're using those conservative numbers and not spending beyond those very conservative numbers.
Because I actually was at a seminar with the legislative analyst from Sacramento who apparently
right.
is a little more optimistic and is projecting more money that's going to come in.
That's correct. That's correct. That's the there are two sets of numbers. One is the governor set, the other is the legislative analyst. Both of them are independent. You know, they're objective. The LAO, we call them the LAO's numbers are about $2 billion higher than what the governor projects. I suspect he's probably right that the numbers are going to come in higher, but you know, the governor said, look, I want to be fiscally prudent. I want to be able to make sure we balance the budget, that we're going to start gradually moving forward. He wanted to be cautious, and that's ultimately the governor's the governor. The governor gets most of what he wants, and in this case, it is a very prudent budget, yet it does allow us to move forward, and that's really, from my perspective, after those years, as you indicated, of enormous cuts totaling probably $35, $40 billion, which affect education and our infrastructure and health care and all of those things that are important to each of us. Now we're going to be able to start digging out of that mess and reinvesting in those things that are so critical to California's success now and in the future.
Now, I also understand that there's a new formula that has been enacted, and
yes.
that's affecting how public schools are being funded. Can you share with our listeners
yes.
what that's about?
It's called the Local Control Funding Formula, and it's a fancy way of saying that we're going to redistribute how we fund education. We are going to have three levels of funding. The first level is what they call the base level. That is the amount that we give for each child that comes to school. That is a very critical number that has been eroded significantly over the past several years. At one point in 2007, we were about 25th nationally in terms of what we spent per pupil. We're now down to 49th because we've had to cut and cut and cut. This base is going to be increased gradually over the next few years so that we are back to levels which will put us, I wish I could say at the top of the pack, but that will at least get us back to a level where we're competitive with the rest of the country. That's called the base. Above the base, we are going to be identifying children who have considerably more needs, challenges educationally. Usually those who are our poorer kids, our English language learner kids, and our foster children. This will give a greater amount of money by a formula, additional money because of their additional needs, programs that are going to try to deal with the fact that they don't have the support at home like other children do, that they have needs dealing with a lack of sort of basic fundamentals that our other children generally have. So that's the supplemental grant, they're calling it. And then there's going to be an additional grant, it's all based on a formula, for children. If you are in a school that has over 55% of the children receive free or reduced lunches, there will be a little additional money for those children in order to try to catch them up as well. It was based on the governor's concept that equal funding or equal treatment for unequal situations is not equal. And so there will be three levels of funding. From my perspective, I fought hard that we'd increase that base amount that everybody gets. We were able to achieve that, so on the theory that high tide lifts all boats, we are going to see additional money for all of our kids, all of our classrooms, so that we can try to get back to being as competitive as possible at the earliest possible date.
Now, the third tier and those that you just identified was the most contentious of them all, was it not?
It was. It was. The question is, how much do we put in to make sure that we get all of our students able to be as competitive, able to compete equally? And so that became part of the discussion. The concentration grants recognized that there are schools where there are additional needs. These are children who receive free and reduced lunch, really low income. They're English learners. They've got challenges above and beyond what most of our students have. And so in recognizing that those challenges mean that we have to provide them with additional services, we have recognized that, and we have added to the amount that we give to each of our students and then target these children with additional needs.
Senator Jackson, this whole process, and you're on time too, is the other thing that's nice and remarkable, and it's balanced. How partisan is it? How acrimonious is it? How is it difficult, or is it, to get a consensus, to get agreement?
Well, you know, we were one of only three states in the country that required a two-thirds vote to get a budget. The other two states were Rhode Island and some other much smaller state. And so it was always contentious because it was an opportunity by the minority party to basically control the will of the majority party. And the people of California, in their infinite wisdom, back in 2010, passed Proposition 25, which now brings us into parity with almost every other state and says, look, the majority in this country rules. We're going to require a simple majority budget. And because of that, we're no longer facing the paralyzing gridlock and dysfunction of that partisanship. The people have overwhelmingly endorsed Democratic values over Republican viewpoints on things. I think, frankly, part of that is where the Republican Party has really moved so far to an extremist point of view that it really doesn't and hasn't incorporated the majority of people in California. But the Democratic Party has done that. We not only have a majority, but we actually have a supermajority. Nonetheless, we only need a majority to get a vote, to get a budget on time. We've done that because we all share similar values about lifting all boats, about reinvesting in education and in our infrastructure, and making sure that we are have a balanced budget, but at the same time that everybody starts paying their fair share so we can move California forward.
Now, how has your experience being an assembly member differed from your experience now being a senator?
Well, Maria, it's very interesting because when I was in the assembly, we did have to have a two-thirds vote to get every budget. And as a result, they were frequently not on time. We were held hostage to certain desires by our colleagues, frankly, for some pork for their district, for programs that were clearly contrary to things that we as Democrats stand for, which is improving education and health care and protecting the environment. Those things don't exist at this point in time, although we are trying to be responsible and not ignore key concerns that do exist, but it's not partisan. It's not done on an ideological basis. This is a very practical budget. This is a very value-driven budget. This is one that wants to obtain a level of equality and opportunity for all of our children, for all of us, protect our seniors, those who are in greatest need, and at the same time create an atmosphere in the state that's going to increase and advance that economic vitality that has been the hallmark of our great state for many generations.
And before we get into the highway that you have renamed also, aside from this new formula for the public school funding, are there any other significant changes that you'd like to highlight or assets?
Well, Sure. There are other significant highlights. We are working to, as we've talked about, mention our schools. We're also working to reorganize and streamline a lot of the programs and departments so that they run, if you will, leaner and meaner and smarter. And this is critical too. We've got to create greater efficiencies. We've already done a realignment. We've got challenges. The federal government has said, and the courts have said, our prisons are overcrowded, and you need to make adjustments for that. We are doing that. We've done that. We'll continue to do that. We're also in the forefront of implementing the Affordable Care Act. Some people call it Obamacare, but we're going to increase access to health care and to health insurance and improve the quality and accessibility of health care for additional millions of Californians. We are also seeing a downward trend in unemployment. In 2010, we were at a high of 12.4% unemployment. We're down to 9% and below as of March of this year. So we're really trying to infuse our economy and our businesses with additional opportunities, the educational opportunities we're giving, the focus on our universities and the research and development they do has been a source of generating great vibrancy in our economy, and we're putting an additional $250 million into each our CSUs and our UCs, where a lot of that research is done this year. We're not going to raise student fees, at least for the next few years. There's a commitment there because they were raised at an enormous level. So the more young people who have access to education and becoming well-trained is a great lure and magnet for those higher-paying jobs and stimulating the economy and our growth so that we get the whole state moving forward, and that's what this budget does.
Now, somebody who's listening who might not even be a resident of California, for example, since we're on the World Wide Web, how much does it really matter that a constituent says something to you or makes a phone call or sends an email? Where do you put that in your to-do list or your priorities?
Well, obviously, it's very important to me to hear from my constituents, to hear what their thinking is, to hear where they stand on various issues. I mean, I'm a representative of my district. Now, granted, each Senate district in the state of California comprises over 960,000 people. So a Senate district is bigger than many states. But nonetheless, I take my job as a representative very seriously and enjoy interacting with constituents and sharing my thoughts and getting their thoughts and having an interaction that's I always have enjoyed that. I continue to do so. And getting their input is always very helpful to me in coming up with the decisions that I reach, which are intended to be the decisions that will properly reflect what I think are the values of the district and what we need to get the community and the state of California moving forward again.
So keep making those phone calls. Keep writing.
Absolutely. And sending emails. You know, it's been a big challenge, frankly. I'm in my first term in the Senate, and with the Internet, of course, there is a lot of interactions. Trying to keep up can be a challenge, mm-hmm. But I'm committed to doing so, and I really do listen carefully when I get their, you know, comments. We're on Facebook. We're on Twitter. At Senator Hannah Beth, and I love being able to interact on this social media. You know, as someone who grew up without it, it really is kind of exciting to see how we can engage together, you know, through this extraordinary Internet, and I'm sure there will be opportunities to see newer and more advanced ways to do that, and I really enjoy the opportunity to have that interaction.
Good, and thank you for empowering other folks, because sometimes they just sit on their hands and they say, I don't matter. It doesn't really matter.
Oh, no,
so
it's not true. It's, everybody matters. Everybody's opinions are important. Even if we end up not agreeing, that's part of the dialogue. We all have to invest in our democratic process, or else we won't have one. At some point in the future. It's critically important that the voice of the people be heard, and we are all the people.
Yay. Thank you for that. That's inspiring. And then finally, talk about the renaming of the portion of the highway, because that's something that's really, I think, poignant.
Well, I think so, too. You know, what this measure does, I've introduced Senate Concurrent Resolution 27, or SCR 27. It designates the entire portion of State Highway Route 101 in Ventura County and portions of that of Highway 101 into Santa Barbara County for inclusion in the National Purple Heart Trail. The Purple Heart, as we know, is an honor that is awarded to those who are either wounded or killed while serving our country. And for me, this is an important visual reminder, a way to honor these men and women who made great sacrifices, in some instances, the ultimate sacrifice for our nation. And I think it's important that we remember and honor these veterans, and that we not forget the importance of participating in the democratic process, because these were people who fought and in many instances died for our continued freedom. So we owe them a great debt of gratitude, and I see the Purple Heart Trail as just one small way to recognize them and thank them for their service.
That's wonderful. Thank you for that. As a father and a brother who have served our country, it's like, thank you for making that sacrifice for our freedoms. And
well, it's something, I think it's a small gesture, but an important one. And I thank all of them who have served and those who continue to serve.
And what does your day look like today?
Well, we start voting on the budget at 10 o'clock. We'll vote on the budget, and then there are what they call trailer bills. There are about 15 of them. The budget is sort of the overarching document. The trailer bills will identify the various issues within that document. There's a trailer bill that talks about how we're going to fund human services, general government, some of the streamlining that I talked about, how we're going to continue protecting our environment and the resources we need to do that, how we're going to deal with the problem associated with prisons and corrections and the courts, public safety, health. There are 15 of them so far. It should take us most of the day and perhaps well into the evening to get it done, but we're determined we are going to get this on time. It's going to be responsible. It's going to be visionary. And it's going to be balanced. And I think the people of California can feel very confident in the work that we have done to make that happen, and that is a commitment that certainly many of us make to the people that we serve.
Well, State Senator Hannah Beth Jackson, thank you so much for taking the time to visit with us, especially before you go to vote in a little less than 30 minutes.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you, Maria,
thank
for having
you.
Me.
Of course. And thank you for your time. And how wonderful was that she made herself available so that we could go through that, and it may become into play right now. Before we get to our next guest, there's a fad out that's absolutely disgusting. We talk about some of these things because, you know, human interest story. It's called worming, and it's occurring in Japan. It's a bizarre practice. The name, the technical name is oculolinctus. So this is how it's spelled. O-C-U, obviously I, L-O-L-I-N-C-T-U-S. What is it? It's an eye-licking fetish. So it's being blamed for a significant rise in Japanese cases of conjunctivitis and something that I didn't know existed, eye chlamydia, which is a real thing. It's apparently seen as the new second base. In other words, the thing you graduate to when kissing gets boring. Does kissing get boring? Not for me. The craze is thought to come from a music video by the Japanese emo band Born. And, of course, Tumblr is got drawings and close-up photographs of the act. YouTube, also. One theory about why it has taken off so spectacularly is that there are an amazing number of nerve endings in the cornea, and the eyeballs are incredibly sensitive. They're saying that it is akin to that of toe sucking. Okay, I've never engaged in that. I think I would have that, whatever. So the dangers of oculolinctus are real, as well as spreading pink eye. There's also a risk of corneal scratching, which can lead to ulcers and blindness. So again, it's an eye-licking fetish. The English version of it is called worming. So hopefully, here's some other peculiar Japanese fads that have, thank goodness, stayed there. Bagel heading, injecting saline into your forehead until it swells out of proportion. Yeba, undergoing dental surgery to give you crooked teeth. And shippo, wearing a neurologically controlled tail that reveals your moods. So there you go. Leave it to them. Now, I was in Tokyo, and they were fabulously friendly, unbelievably so. I kept thinking that they were like Chamber of Commerce members, just making themselves be very valuable to perfect strangers, especially Western Caucasian ones. This is...
Morning, Maria.
Hi, former Ventura County Sheriff Bob Brooks. Welcome to the Maria Sanchez Show, and thank you for taking your time this morning to help spread the word about your book, Declarations, Living and Leading Above Your Circumstances. And just as a little backstory, you were 12 years as the elected sheriff of Ventura County. You had almost 40 years in law enforcement. What brought you to be a public servant, if you will, and to protect and to serve?
Well, you know, the story goes back to my grandfather. I was very close to him. He was retired when I was young, and both my parents were working. So we used to spend a lot of time together. And he was an investigator for the Montreal Police Department, retired as a lieutenant there. And that didn't necessarily make me want to be a law enforcement officer at that age, but it gave me an affinity, and I remembered the stories he told and how proud he was of his career. So it was always lingering back there. And when I got married pretty early, I was 20 and my wife was 18, a friend who was a detective challenged me a couple of years after our marriage to go ahead and take the test for deputy sheriff, and I never thought I'd make it. Walked into a crowded room full of people that had more experience and education than I did and made it through the process.
And so that started your road to law enforcement as an officer, as a sheriff. And then what compelled you to actually run for the office of sheriff?
Well, we had an excellent sheriff, Larry Carpenter at the time, who was suffering some health problems. I was a chief deputy in the department, and the current undersheriff didn't want to run. A number of us got together and realized somebody needed to if we wanted to maintain the culture of the organization, which was very healthy at the time. Everybody else took a step backwards, and there I was.
So the dubious distinction. But you ran unopposed, correct?
I ran unopposed for 3 terms.
Mm-hmm. And now, can you cap out with your tenure? Is there term limits with sheriff?
No, you can remain as long as you want to. There's just some other things I wanted to do with my life, and I figured 12 years was enough. I you know, felt good about where the department was and was ready to move on.
So tell us about the book, Declarations, because it's been published recently. And what is the genesis for this, and how did you go about it? And a lot of people think, geez, I need to write a book, and you actually have.
Yeah, there's a big line between thinking you should and doing it.
Mm-hmm.
I had this book in mind really for years. I felt it was something I should have done. And the genesis goes back. I've been studying leadership for 30 years seriously and have advanced degrees in it. And the one thing that I realized is the basic concepts and the things that work haven't changed for forever. I actually read a book by Ted Engstrom, who was the president of World Vision in the early 80s, and he went back to the life of Moses 40 years ago, and virtually everything that we think is cutting edge in leadership was present then. We repackage it, we make it a little glitchier, we may change, but we keep coming back to those basics. So if anything worked in my career, it was trying to build an organization and a leadership team around timeless proven principles, and within that, surrounding myself with people that believed in those principles and really believed in service being one of the key things that we projected as a leadership group.
Are you suggesting that you can teach leadership, or are you suggesting that leadership is more effective if you follow these sorts of precepts?
Well, you can teach leadership. Leaders aren't necessarily born, and some of the best leaders are reluctant leaders. They're not necessarily, you know, the book Good to Great sort of makes that point, which is an excellent textbook. It's really having a conviction about the right things and surrounding yourself with the right people. So I consider myself somebody of average intelligence and average ability. There are a lot of smarter, probably harder working people on the Sheriff's Department. But one of the things that I did right was identify some principles that have been true over the millennium and apply them to a workplace in a way that I think shaped the entire organization.
So this is your personal path that you had been following, and now you've encapsulated it into the book Declarations? Or is it something that you've learned along the way? Or how would you say?
It's the accumulation of 30 years of working in various levels of leadership and studying. The real breakthrough for me was a number of years ago, probably 20 years ago. Somebody challenged me to teach a study group on the book of Philippians and look at what the Apostle Paul said at the end of his life. When in law enforcement, we know dying declarations are given tremendous weight because there's nothing left. You know, there's no consequence for the person other than what he was able to impart. And that book was basically his dying declaration to those that he cared about. And so I took some key declarations that he made about his personal life and the people that he was talking to and personalized them for my leadership style. And over the period of time, that evolved into some of the key things that I tried to instill in our department.
And can you give us some examples?
As a Christian, some of the basis is obviously that I believe that I'm accountable to God for the way that I lead and the way that I act. But some of the declarations, I will value who I'm becoming more than what I'm achieving. I will honor Jesus Christ by my attitude, actions, and reputation. I will live courageously so that I'll never regret what I could have been. I will pray instead of worry so I can live in peace, having left all in God's capable hands. So that gives you kind of a flavor of those things. They're short, they're concise, they're based on scriptural principles, but they also have secular applications. You don't have to be a Christian to apply those basic things to your life. And when you asked about writing the book, when I retired, it was finally the breakthrough where I didn't have the excuse of being too busy to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So I began the one thing that took me some time is I identified 11 key people who I thought had proven and tested those kind of values in their life and experience, and I built a chapter around each one of those inspirational stories, people that have inspired me, who I see as role models, who I think their story conveys the truth better than I could. And I built the book around those.
So you interviewed them, and then that chapter was your summation of what you gleaned from the exchange?
Exactly. It's a combination of my experience living out that value, their story about the value, and then at the end, taking a closer look at the biblical text that it's based on and asking some thought-provoking questions for the reader to begin to evaluate how their life matches up to that value.
So there are 11 values that you espouse in your book?
Yes.
And can you name them for us?
Well, they're the ones that I read you before, and there are 11 that are those four included in, but there are more.
Okay.
You know, I will things like I will sprint toward the finish line in anticipation of hearing my Heavenly Father say, well done. I will be joyful in all circumstances because God is in control and will ultimately prevail. So it's those kinds of things. And then I found people, some very well-known. Our district attorney is one of those, some that nobody's ever heard of, but they're quiet heroes that still have a great story to tell.
So as far as the work of writing the book, did you have a regime, a schedule? Did you block out certain amounts of time? Did you write on the computer, longhand? How did you go about it physically?
Physically, retirement is a very different experience when you've been in a very intense profession. And I tend to be very disciplined about what I want to do, but I also had some priorities. We have grandchildren in Texas. We're involved in a number of volunteer efforts. We distribute wheelchairs in places like Peru and Haiti. So I didn't want writing to be the number one priority. It sort of fit in the gaps in my schedule. So when you had a day that wasn't terribly busy and you weren't committed to doing some other things that were terribly important, I'd sit down and write. And sometimes you'd have to wait for a point of inspiration to kind of kick you, over a roadblock. And other times I had to wait to either find the right person to interview or wait for them to be available to me. And that would create delays in the process, which were okay because I had other things that were filling my life at that point.
And how did you go about getting it published? You had an editor, right?
Yes, I went through Westbow Press, and almost all first-time authors, unless they're nationally recognized, are going to have to either self-publish on their own or self-publish with the help of a publishing company, and that's the option that I chose. They were very, very helpful to me, did a lot of the mechanical work, helping to refine the draft, design the cover, organize the printing, those kinds of things. But you end up doing an awful lot of it yourself.
And did they tell you, we want more of this, or you've got to cut that out, or did they just go through it and do it themselves to say, this is...
No, they give you artistic license with it. They'll go through and make sure that you've matched all the copyright requirements and gotten permission for every person you included in the book, and we'll deal with the formatting, but the writing is really up to the author, and I relied more on trusted friends and other people that I know to go through and give me good counsel and advice.
Boy, Don, that's a labor of love to ask that.
Well, it is, but you either love it or you don't, and at the time, the process has been so beneficial to me, just spending time picking the brains and mining the hearts of people that have always inspired me was worth the whole thing. If I never sold a book, I would have been happy and given a copy to my grandson. But gratefully, the book's only been out a couple of days and has really taken off, mostly through personal sales and friends. We have a book signing, and we have 100 RSVPs for it on Saturday. So we're getting a lot of positive response to it, a lot of good response from people that have started to read the book as well, which is even more important to me.
So why don't you give yourself the pitch about tomorrow? The book signing.
About the book signing?
Uh-huh.
Well, it's really maxed out.
Oh, okay.
Many people coming as we can possibly handle at this point. In fact, a lot more than we expected, but the book is out at local booksellers like Christian Family Supplies and Camarillo is stocking it. It's on Amazon. It's on Barnes & Noble. and it's on Westbow Press. And if people know me personally, they can give me a call, and I've still got a few boxes here that haven't been sold yet.
Good for you. Good for you. And anything else? Do you have another book in you?
You know, I don't know, and I think it's like having a baby. Mm-hmm. Right after somebody asks you, right after you do, you don't want to have another one. But once you've forgotten how painful it was, you might entertain it. So right now, no, this is all, it's taken off very quickly, and I'm just hanging on by the tail and as busy as I could be just responding to the demand. So, you know, given a year or so, I may entertain it. I really did love the process. It just was such a growing experience for me to go through it.
Well, good for you, and congratulations, and thank you for making the time to share your story with us.
Thanks so much, Mary. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you again. And that's former Ventura County Sheriff, which is an elected position, by the way, Bob Brooks, and his book, Declarations, Living and Leading Above Your Circumstances. And the present Ventura County Sheriff, Dean, is going to be a guest on our program just so you can meet the sheriff. He's been in the position for, I think it's a couple of years now. He's just so busy that we do have a date set later this month. So if you have diabetes, and regardless of type 1 or 2, the University of Pittsburgh have come up with a breath sensor that's designed to detect and monitor the diabetes. They haven't tested it yet on humans, but they are creating that. But it has the potential to detect undetected diabetes and those who don't want to always have to be monitoring. So the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says that they consider it a disorder in which the body is unable to process food correctly to make energy. I won't go into the science of it, but the National Diabetes Information Clearinghouse indicates that in 2010, nearly 26 million Americans at least 20 years old were either diagnosed or undiagnosed diabetics. That represents 11.3% of that age group. So it's prevalent. So what this does is, and what they're doing now is, they're designing a sensor prototype that they are going to be testing on humans soon. When commercially available, the breath sensor should be easy to use, non-invasive, and here's the key word, inexpensive. I have got at least a handful of folks in my life who are in the latter stages of diabetes. And one in particular, a woman friend of mine, she's starting to lose her vision. It's going, and she's only in her 50s, mother of five, and she's pump insulin dependent. But what started happening is that when she was asleep at night and she would slip into the diabetic, it would go lower. The pump couldn't keep up with giving her what she needed. So, and she lives alone, and so she was finding that she wasn't waking up to do whatever else she needed to do, i.e. orange juice or something like that. So she took it upon herself. She's a huge animal lover, dogs and horses in particular. But she got a dog, and she had him trained. And I believe she said it cost $6,000, so that the dog has been trained to sense her smell and can tell if she's going to into a dangerous level. So it's similar to the science with this, where it's a breath sensor. So what the dog does is he sleeps on the bed with her at night, and when the dog senses that she's going into dangerous territory, he wakes her up and pushes her. And if she doesn't wake up, he pushes her off the bed so she falls onto the floor, and then that wakes her up. So $6,000 later, it's saving her life. And obviously he gets to go with her wherever she goes to work and on airplanes and whatever. He's got, wears a little bandana around him that identifies him as a care dog. But I emailed her this article this morning when I found it. It was like, just an FYI. And then the Australian government has announced new guidelines on gender recognition, which state that folks should be given the option of selecting male, female, or intersex. That is happening on July 1st, and they say that they should be able to, and this is whether or not you have had sex reassignment surgery or hormone therapy, it's just what you identify with. And so they are saying that it's going to make a practical improvement in the lives of transgender, intersex, and gender diverse people. Maria Sanchez, thank you so much for joining us. Have a fabulous weekend. We look forward to visiting with you on Monday. Leave you the theme song.